So Matthew chapter 20, starting at verse 29. And as they went out of Jericho, a great crowd followed him. And behold, there were two blind men sitting by the roadside. And when they heard that Jesus was passing by, they cried out, "Lord, have mercy on us, son of David." The crowd rebuked them, telling them to be silent. But they cried out all the more, "Lord, have mercy on us, son of David." And stopping, Jesus called them and said, "What do you want me to do for you?" They said to him, "Lord, let our eyes be opened." And Jesus in pity touched their eyes, and immediately they recovered their sight and followed him. Well, the passage in front of us is an example of someone missing the point. And someone missing the point specifically about Jesus. And we've all experienced, haven't we, a conversation with somebody, maybe it's one of these telesales people, but or a friend, someone at church, and we cross wires. You're talking to them and they get the wrong end of the stick. They miss the point. And if you're thinking to yourself, actually, I've never had that experience, you're the one we're having the experience with. So we all have that experience, or you're the problem. You might remember if you're over a certain age, you remember the old creature comfort adverts. You remember the plasticine models, and they talk about the energy being very turn-on, turn-offable. And, of course, we've missed the point. These actually aren't as good adverts as we think, because we all remember them as British Gas adverts. And they're Siebold adverts. They're adverts for electricity. We've all kind of slightly missed the point. And I saw a great missing the point example a while ago. Someone had a freeze frame of a text message conversation. And it starts off by saying, "I'm here for you, mate," or "I'm here for you." And there's a long reply or series of text replies of saying, "Thanks, I really appreciate it. It's been a hard few weeks. Lots of things have gone wrong. I'm just glad that my friends are there for me." And to top it all, "I lost my mobile. I have the same number but a different SIM, so I've lost everyone's addresses. Who is this?" And the reply is, "I'm your Uber driver and I'm here for you, just outside." And often people crosswise about Jesus. It's been a good week in terms of conversations with people who are not yet Christians talking about Jesus. But some of them, we've had some spectacular wire crossing. And some of it is about following Jesus' teaching. So I want to be good. I want to be kind. I want to follow Jesus' teaching. And yet the clear implications is that that is not... not what Jesus came for. They want to follow his implications, but don't understand what he came for. The passage this passage is the end of Jesus' traveling ministry. And the next chapter is he's in Jerusalem and going to the cross. And these few verses drive home the point of the last few weeks that we've been looking at in Matthew and show us something about Jesus and something about us. So first, something about Jesus. We see here he's the compassionate king. Okay, he's the compassionate king. And we need to see both of those things to get Jesus. He's compassion and he's authority. You need to see both. To get him, you need to see both. Otherwise, your wires will cross and you'll get a twisted view. And then you'll get a twisted response if you only see his compassion, if you only see his authority. Now notice where we are. It says Jericho. That's about a day's walk from Jerusalem. So we've been told already, haven't we, back in chapter 16, verse 21, Jesus said he had to go to Jerusalem and he has to go there to die. And then the locations we've been looking at have been getting closer and closer to Jerusalem. We ended last week, verses 17 to 18, that his mission is to go to Jerusalem, to the cross. And next week, in chapter 21, he'll arrive in Jerusalem. And there he'll be announced king and then go to the cross. And so here we are, verse 26, a great crowd follow him. And these blind men call out, "Lord, have mercy on us, son of David." So it says something about who he is and what he does. Lord, son of David. And they repeat it, "Lord, son of David." So he is their Lord. He is the one over them. And that he's the son of David. Jesus is the promised son of David. So there's a promise to David. There's a promise that is repeated through the prophets that David, this perfect sort of type of king, is going to have a greater son. And this is the one, Jesus is the one that was promised. And that is what Christ means. Often they use the word Christ instead, Messiah or Christ, the anointed one. Not that all these other kings, when we've been looking at 1 Samuel in the evening, all these other kings are anointed ones. They are Christ's. But the Christ specifically means David's greater son. So he's the Lord, he's the king, he's the boss, he is the promised son of David, the Christ. And then it's about restoring. They say, have mercy. So what does this one do? Have mercy. The promised son of David is to be merciful, and he restores. And the prophets promise that will happen, that this son of David will restore Israel. He'll restore the people of God. And Isaiah especially talks about that he, part of the sign of who he is that he will heal. He will undo the effects of the fall. And in Isaiah, the Messiah, the Christ, the King of Israel, is not just the King of Israel, as significant as that would be to the people of his day, but he has a universal impact. His restoration isn't just a political restoration, but everything about creation will be restored, including our bodies. How does he restore? Well, Jesus has already told us in the next chapter, which is hinted at here, that I think this is here because of what's been said and the geography of what happens next, that he goes to the cross, and then this just nestles in there and makes a point of what Jesus is going to do on the cross. He is on his way there when these men call out. So things are as they are because of the fall. Because of mankind's original and ongoing rebellion means that all of creation has gone wrong, including our bodies, including being blind. They're not blind because of their specific sins, but because everything is broken. We have earthquakes and disease and so on, as well as what we do to one another. And ultimately, the thing that God put in place because of this fall is our death. If you really still need convincing, just go to a cemetery, that we die. And that happens to everybody, sooner or later. And after death is judgment. But on the cross, where Jesus is heading, and that we'll look at soon, is on the cross, all our sin and rebellion is placed onto Jesus. And he takes the judgment in our place, which means we are forgiven. There's nothing now on us, separating us from God. But the impact of that is also restoring all the results of the fall in the new creation. So through his ministry, he demonstrates that. He doesn't heal absolutely everybody, but he heals many, many people. They're foretasters of what he's going to be doing in restoring everything, including our bodies. So this is what Jesus is about to do, and that will be the focus of what we look at between now and Easter, funnily enough. Now imagine what's going on in Jesus' mind, if we can do such a thing. So he's been on this journey. So we had the opening chapters of Matthew. We've, over the last few years, looked at his ministry, his teaching, his healing. And then he says, I'm going to the cross. And then what we've been doing since we've been looking at this year is Jesus has been getting physically and geographically and in time closer and closer to the cross. So this is the climax of his mission. So when he arrives, so this is coming to the point where he arrives in Jerusalem. When he arrives, he's proclaimed king. It's a significant thing. A crowd will proclaim him king. And then a crowd will shout, crucify, within a few days. And that's the turning point of the purposes of God and why Jesus came. So this is a big deal, isn't it? Why Jesus has come. He's going to be proclaimed king. He's going to fulfill his mission. And that's going to involve excruciating pain and death on the cross. What's going on in his mind? Now notice a little detail here in verse 32. And asked what they wanted and touched them. And there's a touching detail about Jesus' concern. He is the king of the universe at the climactic point of his mission, of being proclaimed king by the crowds, and he knows what follows is the cross, agonizing death, feeling the crushing weight of sin and separation from his father. And he's not preoccupied. Have you ever had someone, you've had a bad week, and someone starts telling you all their woes, and of course you're a good friend, so you nod and you're sympathetic, but inside you're going, they're not woes. And you think you've got problems. You just had the week I've had. This is not the week to tell me about your woes. This isn't what Jesus is like at all, is it? Jesus stops, and he asks, and he touches. And notice the crowd pressing against him. There's an effort in Jesus stopping. It's not a passive thing. If you've ever been to, it's been a while since I've been to an England match, but when you get nearer and nearer Wembley, you are moved along. If you stopped walking, you would still move towards your destination, like being on the tube in rush hour. You just are moved. You don't have to use your feet. And yet here Jesus is in that situation and he stops. It's a proactive thing. It takes effort. He can be bothered with these two. In fact, he puts himself out for them. Now, on one level, that's striking, isn't it? That given what he is going to do, that he can stop and take notice for these two people. In another way, it's not surprising at all. It's what he came to do. Look at verse 28, which is where we finished last week. He says, even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. He serves others. That's the whole point. Jesus came not to be served, but to serve others. And he does so ultimately by his death on the cross. That is why he's going to the cross, to serve others. And he grants their request. In fact, he does better than they ask. We've been seeing that a few times, haven't we? Often God's answers to prayer are better than we actually asked. They asked for their eyes to be opened, and he opens them. But Matthew uses a different word, translated in our version both as eyes. But the word that they ask for means eyes. And the word that Jesus opens their eyes, the word there means either eyes or can be used to mean the eyes of your soul. It's an unusual word. And they follow. So he's restoring their sight in both senses and it enables them to follow. So we see here something about Jesus, his identity, his purpose, his character. So his identity is he is the Lord. He is the Son of David. That is, he's the Christ, God's King, sent not just to rule all things, but to restore that which he's going to rule. And the purpose of him being here is how he's going to restore that, is the cross. That is his purpose. That he serves others by dying, and he restores them fully and forever. And we've seen before the pattern is that doesn't... We have a cross now, resurrection later, experiences the Christians, but that is our hope of a restored creation with our restored bodies. And it's because all the fall goes onto him on the cross. And the character is that he brings together power and love. Now, you take either away, you have a very distorted Jesus. Power without love is terrifying, and love without power is useless. I think the problem that some of us have as Protestants is that we are hardwired to protest. So if someone, we often react, this person emphasizes God's authority too much, Jesus' authority too much and power, so I'm going to emphasize love. Or they just talk about love, I'm going to emphasize. No, it always has to be both, doesn't it? That true, some people have a very caring Messiah who can't really do much about which he cares. And others have a very authoritarian one that doesn't seem so caring. It's always both for Jesus, isn't it? His authority and his love combined. And as we come back to in a moment, notice also he is the one with the power to open eyes. So something about Jesus and something about us. Now the most important thing here is about Jesus. That's the important subject, is him, and that he is the compassionate king. But because of who Jesus is and what he does and what he is like, there are huge implications for us. And the implication is an obvious one. If he's the compassionate king, you need to follow Jesus. And if you need to follow Jesus, for that you need to acknowledge your need and have your eyes opened. So these blind men cry out, Lord, have mercy on us, Son of David. And that's all they can do, is cry out. They can do a little to help themselves. They're dependent on others and begging. And the parallel versions of this, they are described as beggars. The crowd rebukes them and tries to silence them, you know, keep the riffraff away from Jesus. And notice the irony. They go louder. So they shout out his identity, Jesus, Lord, Son of David, and his purpose, have mercy on us. They've got who he is and why he came. And the crowd silenced them, and when they try, they shout louder. Do you see the irony there, that the blind men see more than the able-sighted? The blind men see, the able-sighted don't. And if you know who it is, if the crowd knew who this is, they'd be crying this out as well, as they will do in the next chapter, and then seem to miss the point a bit later. The crowd are keeping them away, are keeping Jesus away from them. The very people Jesus came for, they keep him, try to keep a distance between him and them. They're blind. These blind men are also another example of what we've seen so far the last few weeks. We see the children, the lost, the first being last, the last being first. Those who have nothing to offer only come with need. And the problem we've seen in the last few chapters is when people think they have something to offer. They think that they do bring something. They think they are good enough. Or they've done something to contribute to God's work. Or they can pay God back at some point. Then they find out they've got a problem, because their contribution can never be enough. That really, we are all in the same boat. So these blind men can't see, but they can see the truth. That they are in need, and only one person can help them. And so they call for mercy. And notice they call for mercy. They don't have a right to him. They have no way of earning or paying back what they get from Jesus. It is mercy. And as we've seen already, they see that Jesus is the Lord, the Son of David. They ask him for mercy. We don't know what they really understood from that, but they're right. They've got that much right. It was obvious to them that they were in need. So Jesus helps those who know their need and confess it. Our need, you may have a number of needs, but your root need is that you are a sinner. You can't out good works your situation. You can't be restored to a point of zero and keep yourself there. You're totally in need of mercy. Those people who will not be saved in the end, it's because they've put themselves beyond it, not because they're so bad, but because they don't come with an open, empty hand. And frequently we meet people like that, don't we? It's for them, it's all about helping others or helping God do his work. That's a great response, isn't it? When we realise who God is, we view people more the way God does, and we want to help them. We want God to use us to do something. That's a great response, but it's not the starting point. The starting point is that you need Christ. That you need him. You need him, the Lord, the Son of David, the ruler and restorer. There's a need. You need him for you before you're any use to anyone else, before he will use you to help others. Now, as evangelicals, which I guess most of you are, we know this. Our theology is just right on this. But practically, I think we miss the point. You know you need mercy and grace. By definition, that means it's not earned or paid back. You know that. And yet we're keen to earn it or pay it back. And we judge how we're doing by our activity. So, yes, we want to serve God. That's an outworking of this. But we often go, well, it must be okay because I'm doing all this stuff. Or we can be a bit like the crowd. You see, as evangelicals, especially at the more reformed end of the spectrum, we've got to get the truth right. That's very important. Now, we notice error in others, big or small, but in doing so, we miss the point. It's the equivalent of shushing these blind men, the noisy, embarrassing beggars over there. And sometimes perhaps we lack compassion on the lost, or the marginalised, or the bit embarrassing or annoying, or just those sort of people. Have you ever had this experience? I've had it a few times. When you pray, just in the morning, just normal, you've read the Bible and prayed a bit, and you say, God, give me an opportunity to share the gospel with somebody today. And he does. And you go, but God, not them and not now. And you almost hear a voice coming back saying, you didn't give conditions. Sometimes we just lack compassion on certain kinds of people. Others, we see, have compassion, but they try to save instead of Jesus. but it's him they need the most. Not you, it's him. And every now and then, don't you, in your own life, you know, you already know the theology, you know the truth, but every now and then you reach a point where you despair of yourself. You're just reminded of what you're really like, and you cry out, Lord, have mercy on me. I'm stuffed, I'm a rat bag, Lord, have mercy on me. In our last church, there was a number of people who were members of AA, and a friend of mine who was on quite a long way through the recovery process actually ended up starting a group in the church building, using the church in the evening. And it's very interesting, I'll tell you about it another time, about how similar an AA service is to a church service. And I went to a guest service, the equivalent of. So I was there, and they joked about a particular member who was absent that evening. The reason why he's absent is because he got very, very drunk, walked on a golf course, got lost, and fell down a sand trap, breaking his leg, which they thought was hysterical. Friends like that. And they said, the reason why I thought it's funny is they joked about he's reached his rock bottom. And the AA got that idea from the gospel. The AA say you won't get help until you know and you admit you are rock bottom. And the roots of AA is actually, it was a Christian guy who started it and then sort of broadened it out. That you need to realize you are rock bottom. To go to Christ, you need to realize that you are morally, absolutely rock bottom. And I think that's hard for the group of you I'm looking at the moment, because I know all of you to some degree or another, and you seem to me, from what I know of you, pretty respectable. And so therefore it's hard for us to admit that you are rat bags, that you are morally rock bottom, and you need help. That you need to realise that you are no better than anyone else, that you may judge that are less morally upright than you are. Now, we realise that, don't we, when we're converted. I think all of us got to that stage when we realise that we are sinners that need to cry out, Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. The problem is later we need reminding again. It may be that you are, and I've noticed this in quite a lot of you, that you are maturing, which is great. That it may be in your understanding, it may be that you're killing sin, sins that have hassled you all your life, and you're getting to grips with that, and then on to the next one. This is good, this is progress, this is all encouraging. But you are still poor and blind, and you need ongoing saving. And on the one hand, this is really humbling, because it means that you are all in the same boat. And everyone who's not here this morning, and anyone who might visit us, we're all in the same boat. The minister, the elders, the deacons, the Sunday school teachers, the old Christians who've been Christians for a long time, those who are young, those who, like this morning, show that they know all their Westminster Shorter Catechism questions, and those who don't are in the same boat. It's humbling. On the other hand, it's encouraging, because when you feel wretched, when you despair of yourself, when you feel you have nothing to come and offer to Christ, and therefore nothing to offer his people and the church, you've got nothing to offer. Verse 32, Jesus stopping, called to them. Jesus has not overlooked you. He is concerned about you. He came to serve you by dying for you. If you feel totally useless, that's a very good starting point, because you come open-handed with nothing to offer and cry out, Lord, have mercy. And he does. Jesus is not going to stop at you because you're remarkable. Is that newsflash? You're not. Jesus will stop by you because you cried out. Notice those who think they're okay, those who despair need the same thing. Verse 34, Jesus in pity touched their eyes, and immediately they recovered their sight and followed him. They need Jesus to touch their eyes. He needs Jesus' touch to restore their eyes, especially the eyes of their souls. Paul's prayer for the Ephesians is for the eyes of their hearts to be enlightened. It's a supernatural need, and repeated in the Bible time and time again. Jesus, early in Matthew, says, only those who he chooses to reveal. At the end of Luke, he walks along with two disciples, and they don't see who he is. And then he opens the Bible to them, and suddenly, at the end of the conversation, they're allowed to see who he is. In John 10, only his sheep hear his voice. You don't hear, you don't hear and become a sheep. You hear because you are a sheep. You need Jesus to open your eyes. Open your eyes to see your great need. If you're despairing, that you need to open your eyes to see that the great need is met in Jesus. And the gospel is not rocket science, is it? For sure, there are great depths in the Bible for us to search and to wonder at, and leads us to worship, and it humbles us, because if you think you know all you need, you do not know all you need to know, and that just leads to arrogance. You need to go deeper, and if you love someone, you want to go deeper, you want to know more about them. And with God, God is eternal. It's even just with the information we have in Scripture, which is limited, it's a never-ending process. No one will ever plumb the depths of what we have in front of us. You'll never know it all. But the gospel itself, how to be put right with God, is not a hard concept at all. But it runs against that grain, and we find it hard to live out. And I'm constantly amazed, although I shouldn't be by now, how some very clever people still don't get it. Not just they don't believe, but they don't understand it. And when they do, it's remarkable. This happened to friends of mine that have been at a good church, and they've done Christianity Explored and the next thing and the next thing, and they've been to church and they've heard a series on one of the Gospels, on Galatians, and they've heard this sort of thing again and again and again, and they go, oh, what you're saying is because of the cross. And you go, we've only said it to you 400 times, and they're clever. It takes a long time. Whatever your problem with the gospel, whatever your intellectual or your emotional capacity, you need Jesus to open your eyes. You need to pray for the lost. It's great that we're doing, great to see you are doing this Uncover course with a bunch of mostly international students, and great we do Christianity Explored and outreach events and all these things that they're good for us to do, and we try and explain the gospel as clear as we can. But we need Jesus to open people's eyes. You will never explain the gospel clear enough. You need a miracle. And it seems we keep needing that miracle, or we'll keep missing the point. And when their eyes are open, they follow. Now, some try to follow Jesus when their eyes are not open. They're following Jesus' teaching, by whatever they mean by that. But which Jesus? The one with absolute universal authority and power to restore, or just to do nice things? Some want Jesus as an idea or an eternal insurance policy, but it doesn't impact their life. Now notice the progression here. They cry out in need, their eyes are opened, and they follow. Follow how? Well, you have to come back next week and the week after to get the answer to that. But we don't want to cross wires about who Jesus is and how to follow. Something about Jesus, something about us. Jesus is the compassionate King. He has the authority to be followed, to power and change our situation, to save us. But he's full of mercy. He stops. He doesn't look over. He stops. And something about us, we need to see our need. We need to see who Jesus is to meet that need. We need to cry out to him. We keep needing our eyes to be opened. There's sort of an initial eye-opening and then a continued eye-opening. If we want to go deeper, it's not just a head knowledge, it's a supernatural thing to need our eyes open to go deeper with him. We need to keep seeing the basic point of the gospel. It is basic, but we need our eyes open to see it, to the point of despairing of ourselves and our spiritual blindness. Not even always seeing that we are blind. We need our eyes opened so we can follow our compassionate King. Let's pray together. Jesus, in pity, touched their eyes, and immediately they recovered their sight and followed him. Lord, have mercy on us and open our eyes that we might see our need, that we might see who your Son is and how he's met our need, that we might get up and follow him. And we ask this in his name. Amen.